Hello and welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast. I'm John Curran, your host, where I explore sense-making in relation to how culture shapes how we think in our everyday lives, and especially with a focus on work and the social groups we belong to. Now, if you were to ask someone what purpose an office serves, or how do people work in the office, you might have been able to have given a clearish answer a few years ago. However, post-pandemic, the answer is less clear. Frankly speaking, providing a clear definition of the role of the office or working patterns we abide to is now cloaked with competing forces around cultural, financial, productivity and socio-political. Anyone claiming to have a clear answer on what role an office has today has either been frozen in the past or serving on an ideological cloud so high up that, well, has little grounding in present or future realities. In this second episode of CVs 4, I'm going to explore how maybe we can begin to explore what the next few years might look like in terms of office design and use and how society perceives work. And to help me with this, I discuss with my guest, Professor Jeremy Myerson, his new book called Unworking, The Reinvention of the Modern Office, that he co-authored with Philip Ross. Jeremy is a leading international writer and researcher in design. His specialist areas include inclusive design, the future of work, and healthy cities. He is the Professor Emeritus in the Helen Hamlin Centre of Design at the Royal College of Art in London, and Director of Work Tech Academy, a global knowledge network looking at the future of work and the workplace. He chairs the Learning and Research Committee at the Design Museum in London and is co-author and academic lead on the annual Healthy City Design International Congress. He has published more than 20 books on different aspects of design, architecture and innovation. His most recent titles include Designing a World for Everyone, that was published in 2021, and what we're going to be speaking around, Unworking. He has advised businesses and governments on design around the world and sat on advisory boards of design institutes in Korea, Switzerland, UK and Hong Kong. He has curated major exhibitions at the Design Museum and at the V&A in London. And it's also worth adding that Jeremy is very much in demand at the moment with the media for his insights on the future of work. So it is a great privilege to have him on the Decoding Culture podcast. Before we hear from Jeremy, I want to remind you that my training program on organizational culture, leadership, and team dynamics starts this September. The details are in the show notes, along with a link to my executive and team coaching page. Also, if you find these podcasts interesting, it would be great if you could subscribe to them. And also, please feel free to leave a small donation towards the cost of bringing each episode and series together. It would be greatly valued. The donate link is in the show notes. Now let's jump into my conversation with Jeremy. Jeremy, so listen, it would be great to get a, you know, I mean, you're well known, you're in the media a lot, you write a lot, and we're going to be talking about your latest book that you've written with Philip Ross in a minute. But it would be really beneficial, I think, to get a sense of you, your journey, you know, in the world of design, the RCA, and then also where you are now with the Work Tech Academy. So just kind of tell us, give us an overview.
Yeah. Thanks, John. My journey is actually very simple. I started out as a journalist. By mistake, happy accident, I kind of morphed into academia and research. And now, the twilight years of my career, I'm kind of combining the two with Work Tech Academy. So I was an arts journalist in the 70s. I specialized then in design and architecture. I was the founder editor of Design Week. I edited Creative Review and also World Architecture. So I was a kind of journalist covering the work of designers and architects. I then, over a number of years, began to work in art schools and latterly at the Royal College of Art, where I'd studied. And I was the co-founder of the Helen Hamlin Center for Design, which was a research center set up, funded by the Helen Hamlin Trust, to look really at the design implications of an aging population. And we broadened out into an all-purpose center for inclusive design, which really took us into your world. And we even brought our own social anthropologist on board, Professor Joanne Bichard. And we were really looking at the interface of the social sciences and design in a way which could help people of all ages and abilities. One of our big areas of interest was access to work. And while I was running the Helen Hamlin Center for Design, I was also involved in the Work Tech Conference Series. And in 2016, we set up Work Tech Academy, which is really a membership club for companies and an online platform, which is exploring the future of work, particularly trying to bring the best academic and research knowledge to an industry audience. And so it's where kind of the commercial world of designing, managing workplaces meets the academic world of new ideas around the future of work. And so that's the journey.
It's worth saying just a couple of things there. The Work Tech Academy, for anyone that's listening, go and visit the website. I'll put it in the show notes, because there's almost a jealous wealth of insight, thinking, ideas, trends, and future trends around work, the future of work, office, and the office design, but even beyond that. And it's incredible. I mean, you can lose yourself. Oh, I certainly have lost myself going through the website, reading articles, blog posts by yourself as well, and many others. So I would frame this at the interface of where we're going, future work. So
yeah, I mean, our tagline is "How we'll work tomorrow." Right. And we have five lenses for this. We have people, place, design, technology, and culture. Yeah. I think these are the five core lenses. And none of these strands are more important than any other. And what's interesting now is the complex interrelationship between them. I think that's what you know, companies are trying to figure out. And it's what we're all trying to figure out, because we're working in a new way.
Well, it feels like it could, those five pillars could sit happily within any anthropology department as well, because it's actually kind of trying to create a holistic ecosystem of what is and could be happening. So the idea of, you know, futures is very strong. So onto the book, Unworking: The Reinvention of the Modern Office. And as you said, you've written with Philip Ross. Why did you write this book? Why was it needed?
Well, we have worked together for a number of years. We have done other books, which have mainly been large format, coffee table, office porn, if you like, lots of glossy pictures of offices around which we've tried to put a few theories and frameworks. And we always wanted to write a kind of think book about the future of the office. And Philip Ross, while I have come from an architectural design perspective, he's an economist and a technologist, and he's very much around understanding how organizations work. He's a very active consultant. And so we thought that bringing these two perspectives together would make an interesting angle on a kind of think book. And we were actually commissioned to do the book in 2015, but we could never really pin this thing down, because the future of work was always changing, moving, morphing, transforming. And we needed some central event, if you like, because the publisher wanted it to be partly historical, 100-year history of the office. And we wanted to talk about the future. And then the pandemic happened when we were on our kind of third draft of the thing, in 2020, and everything began to fall into place at a rapid rate, because the pandemic froze the office It shut everybody out for a few
months.
Yeah. And therefore, there was a break in a tradition of a very important 20th century tradition of organizing cities around central office districts and people commuting to work and the growth of the suburbs and the growth of scientific management and all the rest of it, and the countercultural movements against scientific management. And so we found that starting with the pandemic and fanning out, you know, into the future and looking at the most important chapters of the past, that gave us the structure of the book.
Right. Okay, that's great. And it is a brilliant, I mean, the history part of it, it's really so well woven together, going into the powerful influence of the Quaker movement and Taylorism.
Absolutely, yes.
And these kind of ideologies also of, you know, the Bauhaus, but Le Corbusier, and just these eureka moment. You read back on them and they're almost like eureka ideologies of, yes. But like, you know, Flash Gordon going into space, you know.
I'm glad you said that, John, because people think of the modern office as a place of rational production and administration where logic and the cold science of reason hold sway. Actually, if you look at the history of the work, it's riven with ideology and belief and cult. That's a very interesting a way of reading it.
Well, I think it's a good point. They were, yes, about productivity, but it was also about where we are in society at the moment. So the ideology, cult, religious space almost. And I think, you know, you've got a photo of Jacques Tati, you know, looking over the office, the cubicles and the Bauhaus, being the critique almost of what was happening, which was...
Well, it was a great Jacques Tati film called Playtime, 1960, in which he satirized the containerization of work, if you like, into lots of cubicles.
Yeah.
Of course, I show that slide in lots of lectures and, you know, to management audiences, and they all go, I've worked in a place like that. And I think we all have, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. But it's still interesting. I mean, I'm slightly sidetracking here, where, you know, things like brutalism, architecture, or the Bauhaus, Le Corbusier, I've been to Marseille to see his, you know, amazing building, was whole lifestyle. But we can fetishize it now as something about beauty of design, where, you know, you can, I think what you've done, you've created a balanced critique of actually what it was supposed to be to where it went, in a way.
If you look at the chapter on open plan, you know, the history of the open plan office, this was conceived with utopian, egalitarian views. The CEO would have the same desk as the most junior member of staff. They'd all share the same space. In actual fact, the open plan office became a kind of instrument of control.
Yes.
Very, very difficult for certain groups of workers. Very difficult for people who were more introverted. Difficult for women who had no protection and were ogled in open space, and you know, people with disabilities found open plan office very noisy. People who were neurodiverse. So this kind of universal plan, one size fits all, which was very much part of the history of the office, was actually not democratic at all. It actually favored one group, which tended to be male, able-bodied, fairly young, the family formation workforce, if you like.
Well, it
excluded others.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually, if you think about it, where before that, where you had to clock in and clock out, that was a form of surveillance, but it was actually a contractual, you work your hours, where that open plan of the ad agency in LA, you know, where the basketball court is and you can play basketball or table tennis, whatever you want to, that was the surveillance. That was, if you're playing, you're not working. You know, so no one actually, I don't think many people did play basketball at all. You know,
well,
so
things got very messy, you know, in the 90s and the early 2000s, with the blurring of lines between work and play.
Yes,
a lot of people feel very uncomfortable with that.
No, exactly.
And then theories, of course, around the, what makes companies innovative is people interacting on an informal and a social basis and the water cooler moment and all of that, for which there is quite flimsy scientific evidence. But the office has been through a number of stages and phases, and it's still it's not dead in the new post-COVID era, but it's changing at a rapid rate.
Well, that's a very good lead on to my next question. We are going to talk about later your concept of what unworking is, but I want to not jump into that straight away. But maybe we can explore a bit about where are we now, actually today? You know, where are we with the with work, the office? And I'm going to kind of frame it a little bit. I think it was probably November, October last year, I was able to go and visit some service offices, office spaces in London, central London, but also East London. Fantastic designs, very cool, very chic. And, you know, some of them had top floors with maybe 100 desks for big, you know, startup tech companies, completely empty. No one there. No one, they hadn't been booked. And yet, you know, there was everything there, the gym, the place for bicycles, lovely plants, coffees, the open space, meeting rooms, you know, these type of things. And I left, there were very interesting cultural dynamics at play anyway with the concept of service office space, where we think it is about just flexibility, but I think there are other things there as well. However, I remember leaving thinking, the office is dead, long live the office. Right. And that was seriously in my mind when I was walking back to the tube. So you said the office isn't dead, but I'm kind of thinking, when I think about where are we now, I'm still thinking of just coming out of the freezing of post-COVID, the liminal thing, but also things like cost of living come in. Why do I want to come in when I could save on a tube fare, on a Pret coffee?
Yeah.
All these things. So, I mean, that's my quick kind of input, but where are we now?
So where we are now is in a kind of post-COVID no man's land where hybrid working is pretty much accepted for many companies around the world, both public and private sector. But there is a schism between what employers want, you know, company bosses want, you know, as near as damn it, a full-time return to the office. And they're doing that because, not because necessarily they don't trust their workforce, although people like Elon Musk, who talks about the laptop classes in La La Land, he doesn't trust his workforce. Others do, but they worry about culture. They worry about training and mentoring. In large financial service and legal firms, the model is that junior members of staff learn by looking over the shoulder at senior partners, and they feel that will be lost. So there's a big push to get people to come back to the office more for the higher value interpersonal activities, including innovation and mentoring. And then there's your average employee who thinks, well, actually, you know, working from home has a lot of advantages. I don't have to commute. It's all very well, you know, going to a wonderful office with great art and food and a scentscape and planting. If you've just spent three quarters of an hour on the Northern Line, you know, that's not really going to work for you. A lot of people do not want to commute every day. And they would like to stay at home more. There was a great study done last year, spearheaded by Stanford University's Nicholas Bloom, who's probably the foremost academic looking at hybrid work right now. It was called the Work From Home Consortium. And they did a study in 34 countries, very exhaustive. And they found a huge gap between what company bosses want to offer in terms of days of the week working from home which was as little as possible, and what employees wanted, which was as much as possible. So I think we're in a kind of period of schism. We're moving towards a truce. There's probably going to be a Goldilocks solution where everyone gets something, but nobody gets everything they want. It'll probably settle at around 50% between 2 and 3 days a week coming into the office. And that leaves a lot of empty office real estate, and all companies are what they call right-sizing. It's not necessarily bad news for the office industry because there's an index called Leesman, which measures such things, and they use this term, half the space, twice the experience, in order to get people to come in, employers are going to make the office more attractive. So they're going to invest in design. They're going to invest in art. They're going to invest in better air filtration systems. They're even looking at ways to try and fix the commute, you know, by putting in e-bike stations and showers so people can cycle in, and they're putting up real-time travel and traffic information in their reception, so that everybody know, you know, before you leave the office, you know where you're at with mass transit or roads. So there's all kinds of things going on to make the office more attractive. Nobody's really got hybrid working nailed.
Mm-hmm.
The big tech firms have introduced mandates, and they can do that because, you know, the job market in the tech sector is tightening very considerably, and people are really having to fall into line and go into the office more. But, you know, most people, you know, you don't need a PhD to know that if you're just going to go in the office and have a load of hybrid calls, you know, video calls with other people and do your emails, you could just as easily, you know, sit at your kitchen table and do that.
Yeah.
And at lunchtime, you can make your own food and not have to buy an expensive sandwich or a coffee. So we're in a period of remaking work at the moment, and that has all kinds of anthropological implications, which will be of interest to you and your colleagues. But nothing is settled. You know, people thought that 2023 would be the year in which there would be mass adoption and a kind of settlement over hybrid. We'd get into a standard or some kind of protocol. There was mass adoption in 2023, but there was none of the settled protocol. You know, different companies are doing different things. I was reading about a Brazilian bank which lets everyone work remotely, but every 2 months they have to come together for a week of intensive team bonding. Now that's quite clever.
It is, but as a means of a kind of challenge, because the banking industry is very interesting because they're the ones that seem to have kicked first about trying to get people back. So if you go to Canary Wharf in London, where you've got big banks, but if you look at Barclays, for example, they have invested millions and millions in a new building in Glasgow.
Yeah.
How do you kind of balance that? I mean, COVID has defined it, but you've kind of got this real estate, this bricks and mortar. You know, when you say, okay, people are going to be in 3 days a week and we must make sure we're in, you've still kind of got these 2 days of emptiness, of hollowness. So there is an undesigned tension there. These buildings aren't designed to accommodate mass flexibility. I'm throwing that as a hypothesis rather than a fact, but...
Well, I mean, there are things that the real estate industry are doing to mitigate swathes of emptiness. Mm-hmm. So most new office developments, they're not just aiming for corporate occupiers. They're aiming, even in the City of London, they're going to put a co-working space or a venue, you know, an event venue space, which is the growing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that when people physically come together within an organization, it should be, instead of going into a kind of sweaty, horrible glass box, you know, you go into nicer spaces for collaboration. The food is better. The AV is better. The technology is seamless. And the aim is to try and, you know, if you're just providing standard Wi-Fi and a coffee machine, you know, the same Nespresso coffee machine that people have got in their own kitchens, you know, why should they come in? But if you're providing, you know, classic modern furniture, great experiences, and people are talking now about super experiences in the workplace. But what we say in the book is that we make the argument that COVID was not a break with the tradition in office life. It was a break in where we work, but it wasn't a break in how we work. For the 10 years previously, knowledge workers were already working more remotely. They were working, they had laptops, they could work in other people's offices, they could get things over the internet through the cloud. The only difference is that before 2020, in large organizations, flexible working was kind of tolerated on the fringes of the organization. Yeah. It was the great unseen thing. If you ever went into an office building on a Friday, nobody was there. You know, people are already voted, you know, that Friday was the day when they do their emails from home. And be on the Sun Terrace by 4:30, you know. So COVID accelerated trends which were pre-existing in the kind of what you might call the white collar or knowledge workplace. They just accelerated it. And companies had to officially sanction flexible working in a way which they'd kind of turned a blind eye to it before.
Yes.
And the senior managers were the most, you know, who probably had the nicest homes from which to work and maybe some of the longer commutes. They were the most enthusiastic about it.
Right, exactly.
And there is an irony in senior people, you know, mandating junior members of staff to show up at work every day when they have no intention of doing it themselves. That's another cause of friction.
It is. I did some work last year for an advertising agency, but around their organizational culture. But one of the big things around the young members of staff was that they really wanted to be in the office for two reasons, one of which is they didn't have the infrastructure at home.
Yeah.
They had the Wi-Fi, but not the infrastructure. And if they, let's say Gen Z, and they are flat sharing or house sharing, yeah, there could be other people in there also needing to work. What does actually, yeah, the office look like there? What does the cafe look like? What does the hub look like for workspaces? So that was one reason. But the other reason was, if the senior leaders were in the office, they definitely wanted to be in.
Yeah.
To be seen and to learn.
Yeah.
So there are these other layers of the psychology and the kind of maneuvering the performances, the kind of urban government of needing to have the impression management hat on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite quickly. But it does kind of bring me onto this idea of the hybrid and looking at this idea of, you know, we talk about, you know, 3 days in the office, 2 days at home, but what is home? And I think that that's maybe another question of, it's a hierarchy.
Yes. I think from an anthropological point of view, you know, it is a fascinating avenue, because hybrid work, everyone goes on about what that does to offices, but they haven't really given enough attention, and I include myself in this, although I've had plenty of discussions with house builders recently about what they should be doing. People haven't really thought about the effect on home. I'm somebody who's been a remote worker on and off for the last 40 years. I've had periods, you know, of part-time academic work, freelance journalism. So the home has always been a productive hub for me. And that has influenced how I've organized the spatial arrangements of the home, but also psychologically how I've tended to see work and life as a blend rather than a balance between two opposite things. And I think, you know, house builders are looking at, you know, the need to create rooms where people can work. And this is going to be a feature going forward.
Yeah.
And also in terms of technology policy, you know, in regions and cities and countries around, you know, are, you know, in the UK, you know, our broadband is not as fast as elsewhere. You know, it's hard to get online, and you know, when you're out and about in cities and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Compared to some of our industrial competitors, that's going to have to change if we want to compete. So, what the current state of play in the future of work? We're in this transitional period. And there's plenty of experiment, there's plenty of opportunity, and there are kind of winners and losers. I think the biggest losers will be companies which are based, or landlords who own you know, second tier office blocks in not very desirable locations, which probably haven't been refurbished since the 80s and 90s, don't have the right environmental credentials. That's a big issue nowadays. Companies, their employees are putting pressure on them to be environmentally responsible. So, you know, no leaving entire office blocks with the lights burning all night. You don't see that.
It's yeah.
What you used to. You know, energy saving sensors and systems, shutting down floors when there are not enough people on that floor to warrant putting the heating and the lighting on, you know, so corralling people into smaller spaces, you know, and there's a lot of software and systems which will help you do that. So there's an awful lot going on, but we've not settled on anything. And I think this period of experimentation will go on for some time.
I agree. I think last year I was talking with some in the construction industry in the UK, and they referenced this concept called from glass to brick, where people are knocking down their conservatories and rebuilding with a small little brick extension.
Yeah. And
because it's the office space then. So the conservatory, it's something about brick representing permanency.
Yeah.
Where glass isn't. You know, yeah. It's from a semiotics point of view or metaphorical point of view, yeah. You're seeing the shift, the investment beginning to happen. There's one thing that you also say in the book. You talk about the office being part of a sentient workplace.
Yeah.
I'm just, what does that mean?
Well, a sentient workplace is where you are trying to appeal to all the senses. But it's also a sentient workplace in terms of the office itself being able to sense how many people are in the building, who they are, what they're doing. And technology allows us to have that sentience, that knowledge of the presence in the building. And that's really what we meant, because offices for many years were just dumb containers. You know, you never really knew how many. There was a rough turnstile click in some organizations. But you didn't know where people were in the building. You didn't know which spaces they were favoring. You didn't know who they were talking to. You didn't know the patterns of collaboration. You didn't know the distribution over the working week. All of this now is you know, in a single plane of glass, you know, facility managers and senior bosses in companies can see. Yeah, they have digital dashboards which tell them, you know, who's in. It's kind of a kind of digital Taylorism. On one level, although they say they anonymize the data, but you can see which departments are talking to who, which parts of the building are more occupied than others, which breakout spaces are favored. You know, there are heat maps showing where people are going. Then, you know, companies are getting, you know, they're building these kind of great data sets. You know, they're not quite sure what to do with them. There's so much data being produced from room booking systems, from instant messaging, from email, A lot of organizations have workplace apps, so people are booking their food through their app and their spaces through their app. So there's all this data. And so the Sentia workplace is really a workplace which understands patterns of occupation and presence and then can adapt, you know, to that. So it kind of is the next level of the smart building.
But is that, I mean, that's all, it feels like it's great around productivity and I guess with AI and other tech, where you can bring in these holistic areas of well-being as a means of feeling productivity. But there's also that balance between needed surveillance versus surveillance control, I guess.
It's a very controversial, it's a very controversial topic, John. And we kind of touch on it in the book. And, you know, we have been, you know, the book's had a great reception, but we have been criticized for being, you know, too technologically determinist, if you like, in that we, the technology is here, so let's use it kind of thing. And I think that's a fair criticism in some quarters. But we do allude to the fact that, that you know, there is what's known as data hesitancy amongst many groups of employees. They don't want to give their data. And I think that's really important aspect. And how much surveillance is that? And how much is the company making use of this information? And it differs, of course. You know, I mean, all the trouble in Amazon logistics centers was because they had data on everything. And, you know, they had people pinned down to, you know, how many toilet breaks they took and all of that kind of thing. And it was pretty horrible. And, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, they've had a very glossy advertising campaign to kind of reverse out of all of that.
Yes.
On the other hand, you get Boston Consulting Group, which introduced something called a coefficient, a collision coefficient, in which they came up with a metric for measuring how many random encounters there were between people or social interactions. So they had this big social staircase and people used to meet on the staircase. They gave staff sociometric badges. So they'd wear these badges, which would record conversations and who was talking to who. And they, you know, they were using a technology by Humanize, a company called Humanize in Boston, which, you know, they anonymized the data. But, you know, that's a different kind of, these are very highly paid, high-end management consultants who are also being surveyed. Yeah. So it asks all kinds of questions.
I wonder if one of the trade-offs will be, I mean, again, this is just me kind of imagining, but you can work where you want, how you want, 2 days or 3 days you have to be in the office. But as the trade-off, there is a surveillance culture that will be transparent, but imposed. I don't know, you know, it's, you kind of, whether or not we get to, well, how do, I mean, you also state in the book, there's this very interesting stat, and I think it could have been from the Gallup, but 1/3 of employees want to be in the office, which of course means 2/3 don't want to be. And we've really touched on this, you know, what does this look like for the future of office design, compellingness? But I'm thinking a little bit about the kind of future. And you, it's part of the title, but there is a whole chapter called Unworking.
Mm.
And it's a concept that you and Philip have developed. Could you just talk us through a bit around what does the concept of unworking mean?
So unworking is, it doesn't mean not working.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, it really means, you know, we don't foresee, you know, like utopians in the 60s thought that the new technology would mean leisure for humans on Earth. Well, that hasn't happened. In fact, it's speeded up and intensified work in many cases. But by unworking, we really meant unraveling the core assumptions and most ingrained habits around how we work, particularly in relation to office life. So unworking is relearning. Yes. And we were very influenced by an essay by the American novelist Tom Wolfe in the American Spectator, which he talked about the great unlearning. And he described the, and I actually went to see him in New York, give a public lecture on this subject in the 80s. And what he described was that the 20th century unlearned, you know, traditional political systems and had the experiment of communism. And the Bauhaus unlearned, you know, the Beaux-Arts tradition of art and architecture and design. You know, it was a back to year zero movement. And he used the hippie movement in San Francisco, where they unlearned the basic protocols of hygiene, where there was, you know, communal living and all kinds of diseases which physicians hadn't seen since the 18th century suddenly reemerged in San Francisco. So this kind of process of unlearning, reworking, that's where we kind of, you know, we were encouraging people to, you know, instead of starting, oh, we've got an office building, what do we do with it? You know, start from the premise of what is work and build out from there. We may need offices, and we probably do for certain tasks and aspects. And offices are often kind of flagships for the brand, and so on and so forth. But let's start from a place further back, in which we strip back some of the ingrained thinking and basic assumptions that we've had for years.
That's really great, and I love this idea of unlearning. Unlearning as a means of learning to create.
Yeah.
And that's something I don't think we're very good at doing, especially in the world of leadership and middle management. Definitely aren't trained in the ability to unlearn as a means of, it brings in, you know, as a means of being able to design strategies in new ways. So imagine we're talking in 5 years' time. What are we talking about in relation to the office?
Well, I think we're talking about two seemingly divergent but possibly parallel strands. There's a movement at the moment which WorkTech Academy, in WorkTech Academy we're calling the flight to character. So last year there was the big consolation for kind of the office real estate industry was that actually offices which were of very high quality, known as category A, in really good locations, prime locations with very high sustainability and energy efficiency and all of that kind of thing, they were selling off the charts. Companies were part of a flight to quality or a flight to premium. We think over the next couple of years, that's not going to be enough to bring people back to the office. What there will be is a flight to character. Companies will try and, if they're moving, they'll move to conversions of industrial buildings or heritage buildings. They'll try and create something with a little bit more authenticity and more of an experience, more of a destination. You'll see more offices going into, you know, what's known as mixed use or mixed experience precincts. There won't be these homogenous deserts of office towers in the central business district. Already the City of London is kind of diversifying and trying to bring in, you know, cultural organizations to kind of broaden the mix. So on a physical level, we're going to see a move to more characterful buildings, more biophilia. People are now talking not just about biophilia, but biomorphism, which is a more complete kind of engagement with the natural world rather than just a token green wall. There's going to be terraces, outdoor space, rooftop gardens. You know, people are going to be, you know, having beehives, you know, looking after beehives at lunchtime and all of that kind of stuff. So that's going to go on and accelerate. At the same time, what the RSA, Matthew Taylor, did a great report in which he did scenarios for work. And one of the scenarios was something you call the precision economy. And this is going back to what I talked about the sentient workplace, where you're using software and sensors and systems, a whole technology infrastructure, to really understand. And on one level, you might say, well, that's really bad for people. But actually, if you're going into the office, you don't want to go into the office when nobody else is there and sit in a morgue. You want to know that these three people on my team are going to be in the office. And workplace apps and technology systems allow you to do that. So there's going to be more precision, especially with AI, which is going to have a huge influence, even in designing office buildings. AI in the design process is a whole thing in itself, which hadn't, when we wrote the book just a couple of years ago, hadn't really come through in quite the way. We thought it would be about office management. Now it's about, you know, with generative AI, it's now about the creative aspects. So there's going to be a twin strand approach to greater authenticity of place, greater precision of technology.
Right, that's fantastic. And I think that you also made the difference between the future of the workplace rather than just the office.
Yes. So
the workplace now has multiple strands to it.
It has.
Technology driven, but also place. Yes. Become yeah. something different. Not the, yeah. the kind of Chicago model of sucking everyone into the center yeah. is now. Yeah, I think that's.
Yeah.
I'm aware of time. Before I ask you my final question, I'm going to just tell everyone, I'm stretching for the book here. So I already advised that you do purchase Unworking. Unworking, the reinvention of the modern office. It's a fantastic book. And what I like about it actually now with the historical part, it does introduce, I think, the strand about unlearning. It doesn't, you know, you can actually read it about how do we unlearn. And I think that's already a helpful thing. You need to do it by yourself. My final question, Jeremy, as I ask everyone, I'm going to symbolically now over the digital highway on Zoom hand you the anthropologist's notebook, and now you can visualize that as being a moleskin or a pad of paper, or maybe it's an iPad. I don't know. It's up to you. But you're going to take this, and you're going to take it for a year. You're going to be an anthropologist for a year with your design expertise and other experts, and you're going to go and study a space, a business, a company, whatever you like, for 1 year. Where would that be? Who would it be, and why?
That's a very, very, very interesting question. The one space I would choose, I have to think about that. I know you did give me some advance warning, but it. God, what did I say last time? I can't remember.
When you were thinking about it.
All right, I'm thinking about it. I'll think about it very, very, very quickly. So I'll start now. The place that I would study would not be a workplace, a corporate workplace, or a co-working space, because that's what has typically happened in the world of work, is people have benchmarked against their direct competitors, and they've not really looked at analogous environments. A few years ago, I did a study with a doctoral student of mine, Imogen Privet, in which we looked at urban spaces, we looked at performance spaces, theatres, and we looked at intense team environments such as air traffic control towers. And we learned a lot from analogous spaces about what could happen in the workplace. I think if there's one place that I would like to go and have a look at is university campuses as they're changing, MIT, Stanford, and the kinds of interactions in various departments, because that's what education is about. It's about the coming together of people and the interaction of ideas, and that is to do with the future of work. So if I really had to study one space, I think I'd go and have a look at MIT.
MIT, fantastic. So you will have 12 months there, so you can enjoy that as an immersive experience. Jeremy, thank you so much for being on the Decoding Culture podcast. It's been brilliant. I have a feeling I'll be interviewing you again in the not too distant future as a means of, I'm sure we're going to have some more interesting turns in this whole idea of the future of work, but also the future of the office. So thank you so much, Jeremy.
It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you found my conversation with Jeremy insightful and that you've begun to think about how you can unlearn to relearn. It's all very liminal, but I think we can all agree that we seem to be living in a world that is stagnating in the liminal space, work being only one part of this. Now, Jeremy contacted me after the recording and asked me to state that his fabulous 1 year being an anthropologist when I give him the anthropologist's notebook was not meant to refer to MIT in general, but the MIT Building 20, the magic incubator of the 1940s at MIT. So just you can visually imagine what that must have looked like, and it's well worth having a look on Google and Google MIT Building 20. So please do subscribe to the podcast feed and please give the podcast a rating on iTunes if you think it's any good, of course. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business and anthropology, you can sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link is also in the show notes, along with the link to make a small donation to the podcast. Bye for now.